Friends, now is not the time to be preaching a message of escapism. It's time to preach a message of endurance. That's where hope comes from.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Radio stations that he shouldn't be on.
I wouldn't do anything in partnership with him. I wouldn't, because I think he is dangerous.
The thing that we should be labeling Michael Brown, the adjective that we should use for Michael Brown is the dangerous Michael Brown.
Danger. Every time I say danger. Every time I say danger.
Welcome, friends, to The Line of Fire. Yes, yours truly, the dangerous Dr. Brown. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Anything you want to talk to me about, question me on, please give me a call. We will get to a number of calls on a wide range of subjects today. Got a lot of ground to cover, a lot of important ground. I want to talk to you about an article I wrote that's live today about the importance of preaching endurance versus escapism. Some major news from Israel yesterday, mentioned it, never got to it in the broadcast. A bunch of other things. Want to talk about going from the virus to the fever, by which I mean going from the coronavirus to election fever. Got some thoughts on that. But let's start here. Again, number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. Friends, I want to speak to you from my heart. My goal is not to be offensive. My goal is not to be insulting. My goal is not to be provocative and to drive people away with nastiness. God forbid. But my goal is also not to be popular. Oh, I want everyone to like. Oh, I want everyone to listen. I want everyone to watch. No, I want to be obedient to the Lord. I want to honor the Lord and speak what is right and true, regardless of the cost or consequence. I have no desire to get a bigger online reach or sell more books or do anything like that by compromising. My goal is to reach the maximum number of people with the maximum message. If I had to water down the message to reach more people, I would not do it. By God's grace, I would continue to preach what I understood to be the whole counsel of God, to share what I felt on my heart I'm supposed to share with you for your good, and then let the chips fall where they may. I don't imagine the prophets of old, and remember, as God's people, we are a prophetic people. Jesus reminds us that when we're persecuted, that's just like the prophets were persecuted. Peter says that the Spirit, quoting Joel, the Spirit would be poured out on all flesh. So we are a people of the Spirit. We are a prophetic people. Peter says those who speak should speak as if they were speaking the very oracles of God. In other words, we take it that seriously. So I look back at the Old Testament prophets, not because I function as an Old Testament prophet today or because anyone functions like an Old Testament prophet today. Not because of that, but rather to learn from their example, to learn from their obedience, to learn from their calling. And what I want to say is very, very simple. The prophets did not say, well, you know, if I put the message like this, if I give it a catchy little title. And no, they did their best to be obedient to God. Let me say it again. I'm not trying to be nasty or offensive or off-putting or have some personality that people find gruff and combative. No, I want to be a servant. I want to be Christ-like. I want to be gracious. I want to demonstrate genuine love for those I differ with. At the same time, I have no interest in being popular. My interest is to be pleasing to God. My interest is to have the Father say, well done, good and faithful servant. And I can't imagine, Baruch, who is Jeremiah's companion and scribe, I can't imagine Baruch telling Jeremiah, hey, Jeremiah, I just want to let you know that that message you preached, that message on the coming destruction of the temple, it's really trending well. Yeah, I've been out and about talking. Everybody's talking about, you probably want to preach more on that theme because it seems to really be trending. No, I can't imagine that in a billion years. In fact, there's a great quote from A.G. Gardner, and I've quoted it a number of times over the years. Gardner said this: when a prophet is accepted and deified, his message is lost. He said the prophet is only useful so long as he is stoned as a public nuisance, calling us to repentance, disturbing our comfortable routines, breaking our respectable idols, shattering our sacred conventions. Or in the classic words of Abraham Joshua Heschel in his two-volume work, The Prophets, he said the prophet is an iconoclast, in other words, someone who destroys idols, challenging the apparently holy, revered, and awesome. Beliefs cherished as certainties, institutions endowed with supreme sanctity, he exposes as scandalous pretensions. So, again, some people take this on, and they're going to be the prophet today, and they're going to rebuke everybody and correct everybody and set the whole church right because they alone have the word. No, we never, ever, as God's people, want to have the mentality that Elijah had after calling down fire from heaven in 1 Kings 18. He told the Lord in 1 Kings 19, I alone remain of all the prophets, of all your servants. And God said, no, there's 7,000 in Israel. It's a tiny remnant, but there's 7,000 in Israel who haven't bowed the knee to Baal. They're not worshiping idols. So we never want to have this mentality. I alone, my ministry alone is the important one. God forbid any of us think like that. I alone have the word and everybody else is wrong. No, we are part of a body and God has a people on the earth. And whoever we are, whatever our ministry, we are to be part of a team and part of a family. And we are to have an attitude that's willing to lay our lives down for those we differ with to help win them to the truth. At the same time, much of what we say will not be popular. Much of what we say will draw rebuke, will draw criticism, will draw persecution. So be it. But let it be, we're persecuted not for some nasty attitude, not for having some chip on the shoulder, not for some martyrdom complex, okay? I know people who've got a wrong attitude when they preach and minister. I've seen it over the years. They then get rejected because of their harshness and because of the fleshiness of their word. In other words, they mix their frustration and their burden with the burden of the Lord. So it comes out in the mixture. It's not life-giving. Instead, it's off-putting. And then what happens is people don't give to them as much. Invitations dry up. They're speaking to smaller and smaller crowds, and now they develop this martyrdom complex. It's because I'm preaching this difficult word that very few are listening. And often that's not why few are listening. Few are listening because there's a fleshly mixture and the person has a chip on their shoulder. God's words bring life. God's words bring healing. God's words bring transformation. At the same time, Paul wrote in 2 Timothy 4, that the time will come when people will not have an ear for the truth anymore. Instead, what? They're going to follow teachers who satisfy, who tickle their itching ears, and they're going to depart from the truth. We see that every generation. We see it in our generation. And when you confront the idolatrous gospel of the day, which is a mixture of the American dream, carnal thinking, and the Bible, and you put it all together in what can become a very deadly mix. When that happens, friends, we must oppose it. We must expose it. We must come against the seduction of the church by the culture, the baptizing of the church into American worldliness. We must preach a true gospel that brings a conflict in kingdoms that may cost us our jobs, our reputations, or even our lives. So be it. That's the cost of the gospel has been through the centuries. That's why Jesus says, unless you forsake everything you have, you can't be my disciple. To really walk with Jesus means that everything we have belongs to him, whether we live in a mansion or on the street. Everything we have belongs to him. But friends, as I've been praying, having time during this break to spend more time alone with God, being off the road, maybe travel on the road about 200 days last year, and constant speaking in different settings. So obviously, I'm going day and night in many, many other ways, but there's more time to slow down and get with God. The more I evaluate my life, the more I ask deep questions, the more I say, God, I want my life to count. Oh, listen, I'm blessed and thrilled when I write an article and it gets shared tens of thousands of times and hundreds of thousands of people read it. That's telling me that what I felt was on my heart that people needed to hear, they're saying, yes, yes, this resonates with me. And when we put out a video and suddenly it takes off, I say, okay, well, why? What was it about this that seemed to hit home with people to try to understand? But I am not going to just produce videos that hit home or that get more ratings or get us more subscribers, because that's not the goal. The goal is to glorify Jesus and see people's lives changed. And if it means that we end up reaching 10 million a day, only to prune it down to 50, and those 50 are going to be world changers, let the Lord be glorified. We want His will. We want to honor Him. So I just wanted to share that with you, friends. I felt it was important. Please hear what I have to say. I don't think anything of myself other than I'm here to serve God and serve you and be your voice. All right, before we get to the break, so in Israel, a unity government has been formed, an emergency government because of the crisis there, between Prime Minister Netanyahu and blue and white leader Benny Gantz. And Gantz had said plainly, under no circumstances will I serve in the administration with Netanyahu, but I might work with Likud. And Netanyahu said no way he's going to step down, back and forth. And then there are indictments, charges against him. But if he can remain in power, he can probably overcome those. And to everyone's shock, I guess Netanyahu, just being such a relentless campaigner, Gantz said, okay, tell you what, we'll form a unity government. What? Yeah, we'll form a unity government. So Netanyahu would function as prime minister the next 18 months with Gantz as the vice prime minister, and then it would switch. And then Gantz would function as the prime minister with Netanyahu as the vice prime minister. And Likud and blue and white would be the lead parties. Now, articles are saying there are all kinds of agreements to make this work, and a lot of people are not happy with them. How are you going to make everybody happy in Israel? But we don't know exactly how this is going to play out, with various concerns that Messianic believers have within the land. So we will keep our eyes on Israel. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Michael is on too many radio stations that he shouldn't be on.
I wouldn't do anything in partnership with him. I wouldn't, because I think he is dangerous.
The thing that we should be labeling Michael Brown, the adjective that we should use for Michael Brown, is the dangerous Michael Brown.
Danger. Every time I say danger.
You know, I have spent time on my face crying out to God that He would make me dangerous to the kingdom of darkness, that He would make me dangerous to the devil, that He would make me dangerous to things that are out to hurt God's people, that we would be known in hell, in the old verbiage of Leonard Ravenhill, pointing to Acts 19, where demons or demonized man said, Jesus, I know, and I know about Paul, but who are you, to these Jewish men who were trying to drive out demons in the name of Jesus, whom Paul preached, but they didn't know Jesus personally. 866-34-TRUTH. Going to go to the phones in one moment, but first this. Friends, very, very soon, the virus, the coronavirus, COVID-19, will not be the main thing in the news every day. Barring something unexpected, it will not be the main thing in the news every day. Instead, the 2020 elections, at this point, Trump versus Biden, that will be in the news day and night. And there will be a fever coming up to the elections. Maybe you're into sports and you've watched a game and it's, if your team wins this, they make it into the playoffs. If they lose, they're out, and it's this tense game, and it's back and forth, and who, and you, and if you're into the game, you feel the tension rising. Some of us live like that for months leading up to elections. What's going to happen? Who's the polls? Is our guy going to get it? Is the other going to get it? What's going to happen? I want to remind you that while voting is important, and while we should be jealous of our liberties and do what we can to preserve them and do our best to hand over a better world to the next generation than the world that was handed over to us, we still have to remember that the ultimate success of the gospel mission is not dependent on who is in the White House or who is on the Supreme Court or who is in Congress. The ultimate success of the mission of the gospel comes down to the health of the church. And the gospel has spread and thrived, and God's people have thrived under dictators. God's people have thrived under violent atheists. God's people have thrived under Muslim persecution. God's people have thrived in every environment, and the gospel has spread and multiplied. So yes, I do believe the voting process is important. Yes, I believe there's a lot at stake with the upcoming elections. But my heart is not going to be so focused on that that I take my eyes off the greater mission. And if you think back to, say, if you lived in the time of Rome and you were under a dictator, there was nothing you could vote for, and it's not like you could petition the government. It was what it was, and you were a persecuted, despised minority, and yet the emphasis was put on knowing the Lord, being people of prayer, living godly lives, loving our neighbor, and declaring Jesus without fear. And in that environment, the church grew and thrived. So let us not get so caught up in the earthly political scene that our hearts become divided. Just a word of caution and advice. And trust me, as someone who comments on these things, as someone who writes about what's happening in the culture, it's very easy to get caught up. What's going to happen? I'm not saying that we get uninvolved. I'm saying that we keep the priorities of our heart in the right place. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's start in Chicago. Joshua, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, thank you, doctor, for taking my call.
You're welcome, sir.
I had a question. What would you say to a church who wants to reinstate rabbinic first century discipleship making methods? When I say this, I mean they believe that when Jesus said to make disciples in Matthew 28, Jesus's best scenario would have less mature Christians leave everything they had to be discipled through daily interaction, as they quote Abbot 1:4, being covered in the dust of another more mature Christian over several years. Once they are approved, they would then repeat that process with their own disciples, and those disciples, once approved, would have their own disciples, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so according from Pirkei Avot, remember, this is a document from the 3rd century, and we don't really know exactly what 1st century rabbinic discipleship was like because you didn't have anything that was called rabbinic. To call someone rabbi was an honorific title. It was a title of honor and respect as opposed to something formal. So we don't know exactly what practices were in the first century. We know what they were a few centuries later as Pharisaical Judaism became Rabbinic Judaism. But we don't even know exactly what those practices were. So the best thing to do is to look at the model that we have in the New Testament. So we look at the Gospels. We see that all believers are called to be disciples. In other words, that this is not an advanced group, you know, the super saints are their disciples, then you have everybody else. We're all called to be disciples. The word is not used in the epistles because it would have had a different meaning then for Greek speakers outside of the land of Israel. It would have had a somewhat different sense. Normally, saints, believers were called like that. But everyone's called to be a disciple. There's no question the book of Acts speaks of the growth of the disciples. But for the most part, disciples were working their jobs, being with their families, being responsible in their communities. You even read about, you know, Matthew left everything to follow Jesus. And then later that day, Jesus has a feast at his house. So by leaving everything, it didn't mean that he sold all of his possessions and didn't have a house anymore. So what we want to cultivate is the complete surrender of our life to the Lord. So someone comes to faith, and we want to help them to understand it means the rest of your life you now live for this new Lord and Master. And then in the context of everyday life, through building relationship, through deepening time in the Word and prayer, through fellowshipping together, through various ways, we want to bring people into living discipleship. But the idea, here, if you want to say first century rabbinic discipleship, as if the thing existed, well, that didn't include women, right? So what do you do with all the women? How do women get discipled then? What does that mean? And did everyone leave their jobs? No. In fact, the council of rabbinic Judaism was that you should have a secular job, you should have a basic job, a means of living, as well as study of Torah. So the idea that you'd spend full time studying, that was not the norm either. What's the saying? Tov derech eretz im talmud Torah, something like that. You know, good, the way of the land, meaning working a job and studying Torah. So this would be an overly rigid application of something that may not have even fully existed in Jesus' day and trying to make it contemporary. That being said, we need to be much more serious about discipleship making, and small groups, the best way to do that, individual relationships, the best way to do that. Just big meetings is not ideal for making quality disciples. So there needs to be intentionality. There needs to be quality time spent together. Some will be called to leave everything in other ways and study and learn to go into ministry full time. But otherwise, this has to work with people working jobs, having families, raising kids, having other responsibilities. And what you're describing is kind of an over-idealized and overly strict method that is certainly not called for.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome, sir. 866-34-TRUTH. Do I have... All right, tell you what. Before the break, I will not have time to adequately answer a question. So stay right there. We're going to have a guest on, then we're going to get right back to your calls. Okay, there is a headline, Fox News, but I'm sure it's many other places, reporting a major drop now in deaths. U.S. records lowest coronavirus-related deaths in 2 weeks. And the drop from the highest to the lowest, right, from the highest we had in recent days to the lowest we've just had, it's a pretty dramatic drop. Now, I want to point something out. I've said a number of prophetic words about the virus and about what was coming. As far as I could tell, assessing the word and assessing the evidence, the words were not accurate. The words were false. The words did not come to pass, perhaps just the desire of the person's heart prophesying. All right? There are other words I said, hey, there seems to be more accuracy to this, especially one in particular that was pinpointing mid-April and saying we'd go from phase one to phase two there, and then we'd see a diminishing. Didn't say it would go away, but we'd see a diminishing. Well, there was no immediate diminishing April 16th, which was the final date that was given. But there has been now a few days after a pretty dramatic diminishing. And in addition to that, on April 16th, there was immediate talk about reopening the government, and this is the next phase. So a lot of this, you could say, was accurate. But what does Paul write in 1 Corinthians 13? We prophesy in part. I think we make a mistake when we sit around and try to get specific dates and details from other people, prophetic leaders, others in the body, because we don't always know with that level of precision. If God gives you something with precision, wonderful, but that's not normally the way that it's going to happen. And just like we know in part, we also prophesy in part. So looking back now, if we do see a dramatic diminishing in the days ahead, then that would say, yeah, that word seem to be very accurate or fairly accurate. But again, I think we make a mistake when we look for mathematical precision. Look at Old Testament prophecies, okay? Look at them. Look at how they came to pass. How many came to pass with specific dates and mathematical precision? Very few. Others were broader. Others were not as clear. And then as the thing actually happened, you could then look and say, wow, that's what the prophet was saying. It becomes abundantly clear that it was accurate. But sometimes right in the midst of it, we want a certain mathematical precision. It's not there. That being said, there's no excuse for false words, for projecting our own hearts, for charismania. There's no excuse for that. Of course I'll call that out. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. So, the new book, When the World Stops, Words of Faith, Hope, and Wisdom in the Midst of Crisis, it is now available. You can download the ebook. So on any platform, doesn't matter if you have a Kindle reader, on any platform, your cell phone, your computer, your tablet, your laptop, you can download the ebook immediately. The audiobook should be out any day, and the print book is going to be printed very soon. Everything happens so quickly that just to get it printed and out is taking a little while. But we'll be getting you the copies on our end as soon as they come in. But just wanted you to know that you can download the ebook today. I believe you'll find it to be a real blessing. So you can do that at Amazon.com. And at our website, you can order the print book if you like. So I believe you'll be blessed. Believe you'll be encouraged, helped, and strengthened by this. I'm not going to get into the whole question of President Trump's edict about immigration. It's a complex subject and one that I need to bring on some guests with more expertise to discuss, and there's only so much we can cover in our time on the air. But I want to speak with Dr. Richard Land. He is the president of Southern Evangelical Seminary, and he is a leader for many years in Christian apologetics. He's executive editor of the Christian Post. And we want to address the question, a simple question, which is this. Why are we so shocked by the coronavirus pandemic? Why are we so shocked by it? Why are we so shocked in terms of, you know, spiritually trying to figure these things out and how to handle them and, you know, what's come on the nation? Here's what's interesting. You have people for years like Bill Gates and Dr. Fauci and others saying something like this is coming. Then when it comes, everyone says, oh, well, you made it happen, conspired. Well, maybe the handwriting was on the wall. Maybe these things were obvious, right? But a lot of people caught off guard by it. And then, you know, people raise the question of suffering and, you know, how does this fit in? Hey, the question of suffering is a lot bigger than this virus. The question of suffering is here. Even if there's no virus and there's no flu, there's death, there's suffering, there's pain, there are people going through hardship and difficulty. Dan, that is an always. So that shouldn't be a surprise. Why? How does this tie into the problem of suffering? With all respect to those who've died, and with all respect to those who've lost loved ones, and with all respect to those who are in pain right now because of the virus. Here, let me just put this in perspective for you, right? I'm going to go to a website, worldometers.info, worldometers.info. And I'm just going to click on the homepage, all right? And it's kind of devastating to look at because it gives you the world population growing by the split second, births this year, births today. Here. Births today, 249,620, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 30, 30. I can't keep up. I can't count fast enough for the births today, okay? Deaths today, that's just a little under half. 104,823, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28. That's how often someone is dying, okay? So deaths today, and it's midway through the day, 104,000. Then when you click on the coronavirus link specifically, the coronavirus link, and it gives you total deaths, 176,000. In other words, we have almost that many people die every day. So the problem of suffering and pain is a lot bigger than the problem of the coronavirus. Dr. Land, welcome back to the Line of Fire. Why do you think we're so surprised by this pandemic, sir?
Well, I think the reason is that it's so unexpected, and there's not anything that most people can do about it. I mean, there's, you know, you can socially distance yourselves, but you can't get a vaccine like you can for the flu. You can't take healthy precautions like not smoking to not get lung cancer, or don't drink alcohol to die of alcohol-related diseases. you know, and obviously you have a lot of control over whether you get whether you die by suicide or not, talking about leading causes of death. But we don't have any, we have, you know, this is something new. And what it's done is it's pierced this thin facade and this myth of our having conquered death, so to speak.
Mm.
Because in a modern America, we don't get around death a lot. Not like previous generations, and not like most of the world who live with death every day. And I think it has punctured our counterfeit sense of security as a nation. And people are aware, you know, oh my God, I might die, and there's not anything I can do about it. And they've lost their jobs, and you know that's so related to self-esteem in America that. The statistics show us that for every 1% that the unemployment rate goes up, 10,000 Americans commit suicide. Now, our unemployment rate's gone up about 20%. That's 200,000 Americans who may commit suicide in the near future.
So, in the midst of this, what do you think this has revealed about the state of the church? You talked about society as a whole and with some very penetrating observations. But what does it say of the state of the church in terms of our response or what you're sensing as you interact with the body?
Well, you know, I think that people I've talked with, pastors especially, have been shocked at the response to going virtual, to going online and having sermons online, having worship services online. They're getting better attendance than they were getting in regular traditional worship services, and they're getting people who would never go to church, people who are unchurched, who are listening in, and I've had pastors who are doing blogs now because people are home, mm-hmm. and they're looking for something to watch, and so they're doing blogs and witnessing to people, and I think that a lot of the evangelical church, particularly, is doing a good job of responding to this pandemic by. Seizing the opportunity. You know, Paul said in Ephesians 5, walk circumspectly, not as fools, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. The word time there is the word kairos, for time and its propitious moments. And the word for evil is the word for active, aggressive evil. And so Paul is telling us to pounce upon these opportunities and redeem them for the Lord's glory. And I think there are certainly parts of the church that are doing that in America.
Do you feel, though, that there are parts of the church in America that, because of our theology, be it dispensationalism, be it the prosperity of America, that we've somehow thought that we'll be exempt from suffering, that if really bad times come, we won't be here to experience them?
Well, you know, I think that where this has been perhaps the most devastating is to the prosperity gospel people.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, if you have enough faith, you're going to get prosperous. Well, and you're not going to get sick. Tell that to the Apostle Paul, who had a thorn in the flesh, and he asked the Lord to deliver him, and the Lord instead gave him the faith to live with it. Do we want to argue that Paul didn't have enough faith? I don't think so. I think that in terms, you know, there are always some people in the millennial, who are premillennial, for instance, like I am, who would argue that, well, you know, things are going to get worse and worse till the Lord comes, and this is a harbinger of the last times. Well, it may be. It may be. But yeah, what I tell people is the Bible tells us that when the Lord comes back, the situation is truly desperate. But that doesn't mean we can't have another reformation between now and then. We don't know what God's timetable is. We don't know. You know, God can send the third great awakening to America. We don't know that. You know, that's above our pay grade. Our responsibility is to preach the gospel and to make disciples and to seek to bring to be salt and light.
And in the midst of this, people have talked about this being a divine reset moment. You know, the goal is not for America to just go back to normal and the church go back to normal. To me, we want to learn from this. Like, if you have a heart attack, don't waste it. Find out what you can to change your life radically and dramatically. So if from your perspective, again, not to play God, but if the church could learn something from this, and there could be a divine reset, what major lessons do you think we can presently learn so we come out of this even better and even more effective?
Number one, everything's going to change. This is going to change America even more than 9/11 did.
Mm.
what it has done is we've been in the long process of going from an analog society to a digital society, and this has given it a rocket booster. Neiman Marcus is declaring bankruptcy, and Amazon's hiring 150,000 new workers.
Mm.
That tells you what's happening, and it's happening in education. It's happening in the church. It's happening in every aspect of our society. All these children who have been home being schooled online for the first time and their parents having to help them, this has forced them to become far more familiar with the Internet and with its possibilities. And I think that we're going to have to, as a church, we're going to have to adapt to that and make our virtual, our ministry and our presence on the Internet far more prevalent and far more diverse, and seek to meet people in terms of create a virtual Christian community of Bible studies and worship experiences and discussion groups and embrace it. And I tell people, you know, I've been to the Billy Graham Library now 6 times to visit, and it's a wonderful experience. And at the end of it, there's this digital map, and they have little lights, and it says the gospel's being shared right now in Iraq, in Erbil, Iraq. The gospel's being shared right now in Karachi. The gospel's being shared right now in Mexico City, and then it'll light up when someone makes a profession of faith for Jesus. And they've been doing that now for 11 years. They've been sharing the gospel in over 100 languages online around the world. And more people have made decisions for Jesus in the last 11 years than all the decisions and all of Billy Graham's crusades in his entire life. That shows you the potential of the Internet.
Mm. Yeah, and I remember one of my friends was attending classes at Southern Evangelical online and heard you make comments, this is some years back, about where the future was going with education as well in terms of online, digital. So what you're saying now, you've been saying for some years. Any new books or articles you have that we should be pointing folks to? We just got a couple of seconds left.
Well, go to the Christian Post. Go to thechristianpost.com. I do a weekly column there called Ask Dr. Land, and I did one on how we should respond to this, and I did one on how churches should respond to the ban on worship services by a certain governor, etc.
Excellent. All right, so friends, check out the columns of Dr. Richard Land at ChristianPost.com. Great talking to you. Look forward to seeing you again face-to-face.
God bless you, brother.
God bless.
Next time,
it's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. Before I go back to the phones, let me share this. Last night, I was sitting at my computer writing. I normally write an op-ed article 4 or 5 times a week, probably 5 times a week on average. So I had taken care of some other work, was doing work on a commentary on the book of Isaiah that I've just started on, some other projects, finished praying, was sitting there at the computer starting to write, and I thought, no, I'm just writing. It's not sharp. It's not the real burden to write on right now. So I stopped and I prayed, Lord, what do you want me to write on? Which direction should I go? And immediately felt prompted that I needed to write on this subject, that it's not time to preach escapism. It's time to preach endurance. It's not time to be preaching, hey, before things get really bad, we'll be out of here. Because that has never happened to any generation in history up until now. All right? People have gone through living hell in this world, and God's given them grace to get through it, sometimes with death, sometimes avoiding death, sometimes with lingering suffering. His grace has been enough. Now, you say, well, the final wrath outpouring and great tribulation will be raptured out. I'm not even going to debate that. My position is God will protect us in the midst of wrath poured out. Others say he'll take us out. Either way, I'm not going to debate that. If you want to know my view on it, I authored a book together with Professor Craig Keener. It's called Not Afraid of the Antichrist, Why We Don't Believe in a Pre-Tribulation Rapture. But I'm not going to divide over that. I have friends, godly people who love Jesus, men and women of God who have a different view on that. We don't divide over it. We work together side by side. But please hear me. Every tragedy, every calamity, every hardship, be it tsunami, be it earthquake, be it cancer, be it COVID-19, be it war, whatever it is, believers have been here through those things and have not escaped simply because they're believers. And now is not the time to be saying, well, yeah, the virus is bad, but before things get really bad, we'll be out of here. Well, the people that have died from it, they didn't get out of there in time. Or the people who just lost a loved one, they didn't get out of there in time. And if you just look in recent days and weeks, the Christians being martyred in Nigeria, Christians being kidnapped, Christians being beheaded, Christians being raped, they didn't get out of there. And the Christians in Syria that have endured horrific civil war there, oh, I'm sure there are miraculous testimonies in the midst of it. But many have died. Many have lost their homes. Many are in refugee camps. Many have been in prison. Some have been tortured. Horrific things have happened. They didn't get out of there. You say, well, no, but there's that final Antichrist. Well, let's not even talk about that. Let's just talk about what happens in this world. The horrific tsunami that hit years ago, it hit Christians as well. The difference is that Christians had grace to endure that others didn't. And after the calamity, were able to rebuild life better because they had a foundation in God. And those who died went to be in his presence. So even then, death has lost its sting. But they didn't escape it. I've been to India basically every year for 27 years and literally have washed the feet of a martyr's widow and others that were persecuted, beaten for the faith, man of God, others that may have been martyred since then. Washed their feet. I have laid hands on people, commissioned them to go preach, and sent them out, and they've been killed for the gospel. Some years back, as there was horrific persecution in the state of Orissa, one of my closest friends in the world was telling me what was going on. He said, they take a pastor, the Hindu radicals, they take a pastor, and they here's his wife and children. They pour gasoline on them, and they say, deny Jesus or we'll burn them alive. Who can imagine that? They weren't taken out. They didn't escape that. I've seen videos with my own eyes of people being beaten to death for the gospel. I mean, sickening footage. They weren't taken out in advance, but God gives his people grace to endure. That's what Paul wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy 2, that he should endure hardship as a good soldier of Messiah Jesus. Now, what about Luke 21? What about what Jesus teaches in Luke 21? Doesn't he teach us that we should pray to escape? He's talking about end time events, and he says, but watch yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and cares of this life. And that day, so his return, come upon you suddenly like a trap, for it will come upon all who dwell on the face of the whole earth. You say, well, no, I don't think that's just that final day of his coming. I think that's the final tribulation. Oh, okay. Even if it was that. But stay awake at all times, praying that you may have the strength to escape all these things that are going to take place and to stand before the Son of Man. Okay? So some say, hey, the Bible tells us to pray to escape. Well, first thing, it's talking about one specific thing at the end of the age, not suffering, not hardship in general. That's the first thing. The second thing, the language is interesting. Pray that you may have strength to escape. Even there is a strength, a perseverance required. And the escape, of course, you could be right here and protected from something happening, right? You could escape the effects of the virus while still living here in this world, the same way you could escape some end-time events while still being here. Either way, pray that you have strength to escape. That's not just a theology of escapism. And bottom line, that's not talking about everyday hardship, pain, difficulty. In Romans, the 8th chapter, Paul asks the question, what shall separate us from the love of Christ? And he begins to list things. Shall tribulation? Yeah, that's the first word there. Trouble, it's Greek, it slips us. Tribulation? Will death itself separate us? He says, no, we're being killed all day long. In other words, nothing can separate us doesn't mean we won't go through horrific times. It means God's grace is enough in the midst of them. God will protect us. God will keep us. Sometimes miraculously takes us out before trouble comes. Directs us, you're on your way to work one day and you have the sense, don't go. What do you mean don't go to work? Don't go to work. You have the sense and you wait and you debate it for a half hour. And by the time you get there, your building's exploded. You realize, well, God spared me. That does happen sometimes. Why he didn't spare the others, God knows. But that happens sometimes. But more times than not, we walk through difficulties, pain, hardship in this world, and God gives us grace. We don't know exactly what Paul's thorn was, but we know that rather than God taking it away, he said, my grace is sufficient, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. So I'm not preaching escapism. I'm preaching grace to endure whatever comes our way, and nothing can separate us from the love of Messiah. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. Ben in Connecticut, thanks for holding. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, thank you so much for taking my question. Dr. Brown, look, I have some very good Jewish friends. They go to the synagogue every Sabbath, and they know their scriptures. They constantly, I go head-to-head with them numerous times. I feel like I'm on my own one-yard line. They're getting ready to punch in their touchdown. And the question is, when Christ was led out into the wilderness to be tempted, they say that Satan knew that Jesus was God in the flesh, or the Son of God, because the demons knew. So how in the world could Satan possibly take, tempt the creator of the universe? He knew, you know, with his own creation. So that's my question, and that's my dilemma.
Yeah, so it's easy. Just point them to their own scriptures, that Isaiah 14, behind the reference to the king of Babylon, speaks of Satan himself, called there Hillel ben Shachar, shining one, son of the dawn. What does he say? I'm going to be like the Most High. I'm going to ascend. He thought he could take over heaven. He thought he could displace God. So he's demented and deluded. So he actually thought he could tempt the Son of God. Remember, he comes from that realm. He is a glorious
Correct.
Angel, very powerful, who fell. And he's self-deceived. Look, deception hits you first. The first one that gets deceived with deception is the person himself. So he's self-deceived, and the same one who thought he could overthrow God, and in the book of Job, the same one who thought that he could prove that he could win a wager with God is the same one that tries to tempt the Son of God. It's in keeping with who he is. In fact, the New Testament... go ahead.
Well, they seem to... they say that Satan was actually... an agent of God, or like a prosecuting angel. So why could he? Why has he evolved to be so diametrically opposed to God when he's an agent of God? So that's what they're throwing in my face, Dr. Brown.
Right. Well, why does it say in Job chapter 2, verse 3, why does God say that to Satan is moving God to destroy Job without a cause? Satan is the adversary. Ask them what Hasatan means in Hebrew. Does it mean the agent,
okay.
or does
okay.
it mean the adversary? It means the adversary. So Judaism develops a theology where Satan is basically an agent of God to carry out certain dirty work and things like that. And ultimately, God is God. But number one, what's his name? The adversary. Number two,
correct.
What happens in Job 2? That God says, you are moving me to Satan. You are moving me to destroy Job. You're inciting me. Without a cause. That's not what an agent does. That's what a provocateur does. That's the second thing.
Good point.
Third thing, in Zechariah 3, the angel of the Lord rebukes Satan. He's bringing accusation, all right? He's the accuser of the brothers. That's not being an agent. That's the other meaning of Satan, accuser. It's either translated as adversary or accuser. So that's your third argument. And then again, your fourth argument, Isaiah 14, that this self-deluded one thinks he's going to overthrow God himself and therefore is cast down to the earth. Hey, Muhammad, call back. We'll do our best to get to your question, which I see on the board here, but we're out of time. Friends, please check out my latest article on our website, askdrbrown.org, or on stream.org, Time to Preach Endurance, Not Escapism. And be sure to go to Amazon, order your copy of When the World Stops. It's available today. You can download the ebook this second.